Welcome to week 8 of Kirim, the philosophers. So last time, we introduced this layer of the book by explaining, I'm just going to mute things because I'm getting something in the background. We introduced the layer by saying that Shir HaShirim may be viewed as Shlomo HaMelech's greatest lesson, the greatest lesson that King Solomon can provide. Remember, Shlomo is Chacham Mikol Adam, the wisest of all. And we talked about those who learned Malachim with me last year, how he has great feats of wisdom, which includes his songs, his poems. So the philosophically inclined read Shir HaShirim as a guide to wisdom. And we're going to see Ralbag and Malbim. And Ralbag sees Shir HaShirim as a philosophical guide to intellectual growth. And Malbim sees it as a guide to connecting the soul with God, again, through intellectual growth. Both of them are going to focus a lot on the intellect, although there are other elements to it in Malbim. Ibn Ezra, we said, mocks this whole approach to the book. He says that's not what this book is about. Nonetheless, he doesn't like it. Others do. So last time, I tried to give sort of a basic sense of what Ralbag does, and I think all I really succeeded in doing was creating confusion. So I'm going to give it another shot at explaining what Ralbag is doing, because it really is worth understanding what he's doing, even if you personally are of the Ibn Ezra bent in terms of trying to understand this book, even if you think that that's not what this book is about. So we begin by noting, well, I said it last time, I didn't bring it on the sheet again, that Ralbag is a philosopher who sees Shlomo, King Solomon, communicating ultimate truth to the elite, to other Shlomos. That's really what he understands is going on here. And Ralbag says all the other commentaries on it are really nice ideas, they're beautiful, but they're not what Shir HaShirim is about. He says, I know what Shir HaShirim is about, and Shir HaShirim is a guide to using your mind. That's all review from last time. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 1, where we're going to get a clearer sense from Ralbag about how Shir HaShirim does this. Okay, everyone has the sheet? We're good? Okay. So I'm going to go with my English translation, as opposed to doing Hebrew and English back and forth, because there's just so much text here that I don't want to spend time on that. You can see the Hebrew, you can see my translation, and work with both. Ralbag says, it is explicit and evident from the Torah and prophets and from logic that the ultimate success intended for a person, what Hashem wants us to achieve, is when he gains insight and knows Hashem as he is able. Kfi ma'ashev shirlo. The height is for you to know God to whatever extent a human being can know God. This will become complete for him when he examines that which exists, its order, and divine wisdom in making them as they are. In other words, what you need in order to achieve this knowledge of God is an understanding of nature. You need to know the world around you. Now keep in mind that in Ralbag's philosophical world in the Middle Ages, Ralbag, I think we said, is 14th century, maybe into the 15th, but I think primarily 14th. Someone will listen to this audio recording and correct me. But Ralbag is somewhere around 14th century. In his world, a lot of scientific knowledge is really philosophy, what we would call philosophy. So that's what he says you need to excel in order to understand God. These lessons, he says, we're on the third line in the translation in source number 1, these lessons will direct the human being to knowledge of God on some level. When you understand nature, you will understand God. Why? For the action teaches about the actor on some level. If you can understand what God created, that will give you an understanding of God on some level, he says. Meaning, the action which is perfect teaches us about the most perfect actor as the actor. And through this we may learn and know Hashem, since Hashem created it, and since I can see that this entity God created is perfect, Therefore, I will appreciate divine perfection. So he writes. I don't want to get into, too much of that. There's an awful lot of discussion you could have about this and science and evolution and all sorts of other fun stuff, but it's not for right now. He says, it should not be lost upon us, second paragraph in the first source, it should not be lost upon us that in achieving this great success for which we are prepared, there is great difficulty, to the extent that reaching that goal is very remote for people, and even a great portion of it will be achieved only by a very small number of people. He says, it's all well and good for me to tell you that when you understand the world, you will understand God, but most people never get to that point of understanding the world, or even understanding most of the world. He says, this is for two reasons. You want to know why? One, the difficulty of grasping perfectly that which exists. Number one, because the world is a hard place to understand. Number two, the many obstacles we have in trying to grasp this appropriately, there are obstacles that we have in our attempts to grasp that. There are character flaws that make it challenging to even make the attempt to grasp it. The Torah is perfect, he says, for individuals and for the masses in guiding toward this goal. If we wish to explain this guidance from the Torah's words, we would need an extensive treatise. He says, I can't really explain to you how the Torah guides you to this goal, but I can tell you that the Torah guides you to this goal. He says, we will abbreviate. I abbreviate it even further by putting in the ellipsis. And we will say that what we should first guide ourselves towards is perfection of character traits. He says, the first step, you want to understand God, understand the world. You want to understand the world, you better first perfect your character. The Torah guided us toward this perfection explicitly with many of the mitzvot. But that which comes to perfect the spirit is hidden, remote from the masses. He says, mitzvot are intended to improve our character. But you don't know how, you just do the mitzvah. That's number one. And then he says, but this book, the Song of Songs, directs only individuals to the path to achieve success. He says, Torah is the path for most people, who will do it and achieve greatness even without understanding how they're doing it. Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, that's for unique people. That's for shlomos, individuals. Therefore, its visible layer was not presented for the masses. As it appears to us from its words, it first pointed to removal of the obstacles which come from deficient character, and then it pointed to removal of the obstacles which come from an inability to distinguish truth and between truth and falsehood, and then it pointed to guidance and insights according to the proper order. He says, Shir HaShirim is going to help us, teaching us how to get rid of the obstacles to our intellectual growth, and teaching us how to grow intellectually. But you have to be named Ralbag in order to really understand. So don't worry, he says. I'll help you out. I'm going to write an explanation of how Shir HaShirim helps you to do this. I'm not asking the following question. Well, the following question is not... Let me say it this way. I'm going to ask any questions, or is that clear? But I don't really mean, is that clear? Because I know it's not clear. But do you follow what he thinks he's getting across, what he's trying to teach us? Right now, he hasn't given us answers. He's telling us what he thinks we can get out of Shir HaShirim, which is, this is your guide to intellectual perfection, but you have to be on a high level in order to grasp it from Shir HaShirim. So I'm going to help you by showing you how Shir HaShirim does this. So he says, there are six parts to the book. And I gave you in source number two my digest of it. It's in his introduction and it goes on for a while. So I just thought I would just give you a little table here. The first part of the book is the opening seven verses. The introduction to the book, key ideas are hinted at in it. Then the second part, removing the obstacles which come from having a deficient character. That's the second part. By the way, you may notice his poems, the way he breaks it up into its units, are not so different in terms of the breakdowns from others. There are certain natural breakpoints in the book. He just thinks the contents of each part are different from what others do. The third part, he says, is about how to avoid intellectual error. So if you master Shir HaShirim, you will know how to avoid intellectual error. And look, it's only 9 verses in the second chapter. Fourth, how to achieve the wisdoms which are learned. That which you can learn, that which can be absorbed. Then how to understand the universe Hashem created, and that's the bulk of the book, you see, right? From middle of chapter 4 till almost the end. And then finally, understanding divine wisdom. Those are your steps. I'm not spending a lot of time on the steps because they're not going to add much to our understanding. I just wanted you to see that he breaks it down that way. What I want to do, though, is explore how this plays out for Ralbag. How does he read Shir HaShirim? What does he do? When you open your Shir HaShirim, if you want to read Shir HaShirim like Ralbag, what are you seeing? So I gave you a breakdown of the main players, and we're going to go step by step. The first player is the female, the Ra'aya, right? Which we, and when we read it in earlier layers, we said the Ra'aya is either the Jewish people, right? That's the female in the story, or the individual who is trying to relate to God in the Rambam's read, right? Those were what we read so far. He says, actually, the female in the story is what we call the hilik, I think it's hilik and not hilik, I hope that's right. The hilik intellect. That's what it is. So everyone says, oh, okay, I get it. Good, next line. We're going to come back to the hilik intellect in a second. The male, right, keep in mind what the male was in earlier readings, the male was Hashem. Right, the hilik intellect could be the Jews, or it could be the individual person, but the male is God. So in his version of it, the male is what I called here the active intellect. In Hebrew, it is called the Seichel HaPoel. And these are the shoals on which we ran aground last time. But this time, we're going to get it. Because this time, I came prepared to really discuss this. It was very interesting for me, because I knew I had given a class on the active intellect at some point, but I didn't remember how much I had done. It turns out I had a Kuzari Chabura that met going back 10 years ago. And I'd actually done a lot of exploring into the Seichel HaPoel, and I remember none of it now. Ralbag would be disappointed. But it's going to help us, because I found my notes. So let's talk about the Seichel HaPoel, the active intellect, before we come back to the Hilik intellect. The active intellect, also known as the active mind. First of all, for anyone who researches this online, you have to recognize the Greek concept of the active intellect does not necessarily match the Jewish one. If anybody wants sources in Aristotle, I'm happy to give you them and, you know, enjoy yourself. I gave you a link actually in source number 4 where you could find more about the active intellect, so to your heart's content. I'm dealing with the Jewish understanding of it, found in the Rishonim, in the medieval authorities whose names we recognize from elsewhere in Torah. So basically their concept is this. God, creator of the universe, sends his influence to our physical realm through intermediaries. The intermediaries filter it until it's something that our world can absorb and make use of. Those are angelic beings, essentially. They're not physical entities. They're celestial. The bottom layer of this, the last rung in the ladder, so to speak, right? You're jumping up to the fire escape, so the bottom rung of the fire escape is the Seichel HaPoel. That's the active intellect. It is a purely intellectual, spiritual force created by God to run the affairs of this world. That's the Seichel HaPoel. That's the Dod in Shir HaShirim, according to Ralbag. That's the beloved male. There is some variation in the Jewish writers on this regarding exactly what the Seichel HaPoel does and can do. I brought you on your sheet, if you flip to the next side, source number 5 from the Rambam's Mora Nebuchim. Guide for those who wish to be perplexed. He says in source number 5, Hashem Yisbarach Hu Asher Himtzi HaSeichel HaRishon. He says, God is the one who created the first intellect. Asher HaSeichel HaHu Menia HaGalgal HaRishon Al Atzad Asher Biarnu. And that sets in motion the first sphere. Remember that Rambam is using a cosmology which views the universe as spheres within spheres. And we are inside. So you go, God has a first intellect that he creates that moves the outermost sphere. Vaseichel Asher Yagia HaGalgal HaSheini. He says the second sphere is being moved by an intellect that is caused by the first sphere, and so on, until you get to the last one. He says until you finally get to the intellect that moves our sphere, the sphere that's closest to us. And that is this active intellect, the Seichel HaPoel. So the one that's actually moving our world is the Seichel HaPoel. Got that? I don't mean got it in the sense that really get it, but get it in the sense that, okay, I know what he's talking about. Janine.
So is the Seichel HaPoel the lowest level or the highest level?
The lowest level.
Oh, okay.
That is the lowest level. To us, it's the highest level that we can get close to. But it is actually the lowest level. That's correct. So that's the way the Rambam explains it. Ramban discusses it when he talks about the prohibition against eating blood. So he throws in this piece in which invokes the Seichel HaPoel. If you look at source number 6, Valaderech HaYivani, he says the Greek approach, Sheru Chokrav, which their philosophers see. That from this active intellect comes a spark of pure radiance. From that emerges the spark of the animal nefesh. So it's coming out of the Seichel HaPoel and it's in the animal's blood, and therefore you're not supposed to eat the animal's blood. Rabbeinu Bachaye, who was a student of the Rashba, so he's a little later than Ramban, a couple of generations later than Ramban, brings in the Seichel HaPoel when he talks about the fight between Yaakov and that mysterious being during the night. Right? You can save this one for Parshas Vayishlach. You'll impress your friends. The Rabbeinu Bachaye says in source number 7 that the Ish Yaakov battles is Gabriel, which is the Seichel HaPoel, the active intellect. The 10th level of the malachim who are called Ish. That's the idea. And he says, Yaakov, I'm just reading my translation. Yaakov wished to know whether he could have an intellectual soul on the level of the active intellect, which is free of all material while still attached to the material world. Yaakov wants to be very spiritual. The Ish informed him this would not be possible until the morning rose, meaning until he would leave the darkness of the body for the pure light identified as morning. We could pretend that was clear. The statement that he's making, though, they're all talking about the same idea, that there is this lowermost angelic being that is conveying something and is controlling something. And finally, in number 8, I brought Yuval Bag, towards the end of Shmuel Beis, where he talks about a verse which describes God riding a kruv, a cherub. And he says that cherub is the active intellect which God sends to oversee humanity. We actually discussed this. Those who learned Yeshaya with me a few years ago, or who learned Yehoshua with me a lot longer ago, we talked about Ralbag on the Seichel HaPoel because there's a big fight about what the Seichel HaPoel is capable of doing. What exactly can it do? Ralbag said the Seichel HaPoel is not able to affect the sun and the moon because they're in a higher sphere. And so he says, the sun and the moon don't stop with Yehoshua, or, you know, the sun doesn't go backward in the time of Yeshaya with that miracle that he poured. He says it can't be, because this is, it's above the pay grade of the Seichel HaPoel. So the point being for us, that the active intellect, the Seichel HaPoel, is the lowest form of divine influence in our world, but way above human beings. And the goal of the human being, here's the key for Shir HaShirim, is to connect with the Seichel HaPoel. We would like to be able to link up with the Seichel HaPoel. What happens if you link up with the Seichel HaPoel? Can you guess? You become a Navi. That's prophecy. When you can connect with that lowest form of divine oversight of the world, you tap into knowledge of how the world works. Great spiritual insight. The Kuzari says this in the beginning of the Kuzari in source number 9. The translation I brought you is the Hirschfeld translation because it's available for cutting and pasting online. And I did enough translating. He says, in the perfect person, a light of divine nature called active intellect is with him. And its passive intellect is so closely connected therewith that both are but one. When he says the passive intellect, he means the human mind, not the one that controls things. So they become one. The person of such perfection thus observes that he is the active intellect himself and that there is no difference between them. His organs, I mean the limbs of such a person, only serve for the most perfect purposes in the most appropriate time and in the best condition, as if they were the organs of the active intellect, but not of the material and passive intellect which used them at an earlier period, sometimes well, more often improperly. He says, your body becomes an agent of the Seichel HaPoel, the active intellect. The active intellect, however, is always successful, not like the body that fails. And he says, this degree is the last and most longed for goal for the perfect man whose soul, after having been purified, has grasped the inward truths of all branches of science, but thus become equal to an angel, and has found a place on the nethermost step of seraphic beings. Was that somewhat clear? I mean, that's not so hard. He says, you can attain an angelic existence, says the Kuzari. That's a really big deal for the Kuzari, because the Kuzari is a believer in the idea that that's what we aspire to for Olam Haba. Life in the next world is, you reach that point where you make that connection, where you're tapped into that bond. So that, let's come back to Shir HaShirim. In Shir HaShirim, as Ralbag understands it, the Hilik intellect, which is the human intellect, which is the capacity to learn, that's the Hilik intellect as far as we are concerned, the capacity to learn, Shir HaShirim is about that human intellect aspiring to connect with the active intellect. We are the woman in Shir HaShirim trying to connect with the active intellect, which is the man in Shir HaShirim. Got it? See that? That wasn't so hard. That's the idea. So who are the players in our story? Well, for starters, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, you can go back to the first side, to source number 3, to my list. He is also the active intellect. In other words, the references to Shlomo are references to the Dode. They're not two different parties. They're the same. Jerusalem is the complete human being. Yeru Shalem, right? Whole, to be complete. It contains within it all of the components that are needed to serve God. And that's the population of Jerusalem. So that, as I wrote on your sheet, the daughters of Jerusalem who show up in the story, those are the powers of the nefesh, of the soul. The Benot Zion, the daughters of Zion, are the powers of the soul that most closely serve the intellect, because Zion is the most elevated part of Yerushalayim. What about all the natural imagery in the book? There's a lot about light, right, and the dawn. So he says the dawn is the dawning of the intellect, the elimination of intellectual darkness. That's what we're going for. The flowers, the plants bearing fruit, that's the intellect developing, achieving heights. The spices and oils, so those are different insights. Some of them are about nature, some of them are about God. And all the praises that you see back and forth, praise for the Dod and praises for the Ra'aya, he says some of them don't really fit the Mashal. They don't fit the external layer of the book, which describes a man and a woman pursuing each other, and that's meant to make us realize that there is a hidden layer to the book. So he says some of the praises don't really fit. They, you know, what you would think of in a romance, it's meant to tell you this book isn't really a romance. On the other hand, he says, some of the praises don't really fit the whole hidden layer about the intellect. That's in order to make sure that you have a complete parable by telling a story about the man and a woman, and also to make sure that not everybody can figure out what this book is about, because it's not really for everybody. Unless you buy my book, and then I can explain it to you. But that's the way he reads this. So, Professor Menachem Kellner, who I mentioned already last week, helps us out a little bit in terms of how to read the story. If you take a look at source number 10, he says there are two dialogues going on in this story. The first dialogue is between the human's material intellect, the hilic intellect, right, and the active intellect, and they're trying to join together. And then the second dialogue is between the soul, the daughters of Jerusalem, and the human material intellect. In other words, one dialogue is between us and this higher thing, and the other is between us and our lower aspects, our own lower aspects. We're conversing with both sides. If you take a look at source number 10, that's where I brought you from Kellner's introduction to the translation of Ralbag. This is available on, this part of it is available online. You can't get his actual translation, like, except bits and pieces on Google Books. But he says, in his commentary, Gersonides, Ralbag, reads the text not as a dialogue between two physical lovers, nor as the Talmudic rabbis had read it as a dialogue between God and the house of Israel, but as two dialogues. In Gersonides' view, the first dialogue is between the human material intellect and the active intellect, the kind of conjunction with which is a human being's highest perfection and greatest felicity, right? Our greatest happiness. The second is between the faculties of the soul and the material intellect. These are not dialogues in the true sense, since in most instances Gersonides construes the participants in this discussion as talking about and not to each other. Right? The beloveds speak about each other. In any event, the main thrust of these discussions relates to the overwhelming desire of the material intellect to approach the active intellect and its attempt to enlist the willing aid of the other faculties of the soul in this quest. Okay, so if someone asks you, what is Shir HaShirim about? Right? You can now tell them, it's Midrashim about Hashem's love for the Jewish people, and everything is, you know, beautiful and lovely and wonderful. It is about the history of the Jews and their back and forth relationship with God presented in a narrative. It is about the individual seeking God, and trying to have a relationship with God. Or, I now have an additional tool, it's about the human being trying to connect with prophecy, trying to reach the lowest level of the angels and bond at that level. Got it? So I love the last piece. Hang on one second with a comment. I love the last piece I brought on Ralbag in source number 11. My mouth hung open when I read this. This is also Professor Kellner from his introduction. He says, the most amazing thing about this commentary, at least so far as this reader is concerned, is the way in which Gersonides' approach, absurd on the face of it as an attempt to explicate the true meaning of the text as intended by its author, becomes more and more convincing as one goes along. I'm going to take his word for it. He says, the more you read this, the more you're sure that that's exactly what this is about. Really? Okay. I mean, he's the philosopher. I decidedly am not. I am an amateur of the amateurs, trying to wrap my head around philosophy. But he says, yeah, no, the more you read it, the more you think, oh, that's totally pshat and Shir HaShirim. Okay, fine. Janine, you were going to say?
I wonder how he thinks about the fact that this, according to him, and Shira Shirekbit at the creme de la creme of the world, very few people, and yet it's included in Tanakh. I mean, they're esoteric, like Zohar was not meant for everybody to be read. Why is this provided so openly for everyone, even though only a very minute?
It's an interesting question, and really we would need to know more about Ralbag's views of canonization than I do. But I would guess he would feel this is a very appropriate place for it, because you want the intellectual elite to look to Tanakh for guidance, and you would want them to have a place where they are able to find inspiration as well. Tanakh shouldn't just be for everybody. It should also have something to inspire the greatest. That would be my guess, but that's really my thinking, not his. I don't know how he looked at it. Yeah, it's a good question. But he also believes that it's concealed. And he's right in that regard. Because I wouldn't have read it and gotten that out of it at all. So, good job, concealing. So that's Ralbag. Any other comments or questions about Ralbag? Not about him personally, but... Okay, so, yes, Sandra. Sorry, Sandra, you're muted.
I'm a lot confused, but did you say that Nebuah was the closest thing that we humans had to getting to understand the higher echelon?
Yes.
So in that case, why was Nebuah taken away from people after the...
The theory is that it's not taken away after the first Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. It disappears after the generation of Malachi, which is a couple of generations into the second Beit HaMikdash.
Oh, okay.
But I think I'd have to go back to the Kuzari, because he talks about Nevuah a lot. Ralbag presumably also, but I have less familiarity. But I think the answer would be because of being unworthy. In other words, this takes a lot. If someone were to achieve it, they would get it.
But it took away the ability for people to even, unless I'm not understanding what it means that Nebuah was taken away.
Right.
Does it mean that people were not worthy enough to attain Nebuah?
Yeah. Right, so there is a lot of discussion about this, and the answer is not clear. However, the lowest rungs of Nevuah still exist. Ruach HaKodesh still exists in our day. That's not something that's taken away. Even if I take the view of taking away, the Ruach HaKodesh remains. The question is about beyond that. We've talked about Ruach HaKodesh before. I'm not going to go through the whole thing right now. But we've had this conversation about Ruach HaKodesh as the lowest level of prophecy.
Is that like when you go to a setting for a bracha? Is that what you mean by Ruach HaKodesh?
So, no, I don't want to go into the whole Ruach HaKodesh discussion now. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It's a further field thing.
I'm not familiar with it, but okay.
Yeah, Ricky.
Does he give any specific examples, let's say, of one interchange between Shlomo and the Raya that actually demonstrated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, there's a whole book. His commentary is available. If you want to pursue it, my recommendation would be to go to the site mg.alhatorah.org. I haven't used it much, but recently I had reason to use it. And it's good. The fact that I haven't used it should not bias anybody. I'm going to put the link in. I'm putting the link in here. And what they do in this site, MG stands for Mikraot Gedolot. So you can go verse by verse, and they give you, it's in Hebrew, they'll give you all of the, not all of the, but a lot of commentaries, including some that are not standard commentaries. They're not available elsewhere. That's why I've been using it lately. I'm doing a shiur elsewhere on Rav Sajagon. And they have him on the on Chumash, so it's very useful in that regard. So if you look there at Shir HaShirim, you can get Ralbag's commentary, Ricky, and to your heart's content.
Okay, do you know of a specific? Can you describe one little
sample? No. No, I skipped it on purpose. Because it's really like, yeah, for me, this is not the most compelling layer in Shir HaShirim. I am presenting it in the interests of authenticity, I'm not buying into source number 11. Okay. I want to jump in history to the Malbim. Malbim is semi-modern times. You're now talking 18th century, 19th century, and this is also a philosophical approach. It's a more familiar form of philosophy for our age. We see some philosophical terminology. We're not getting away entirely from that. It's more graspable, I find. And for this, Ricky, I am planning on showing you how he does it. Because Malbim is a lot easier for us to approach. Malbim writes his commentary on Shir HaShirim in two forms. We've seen that others did that also, did multiple layers. We saw Rashi did it at certain points. We saw that Ibn Ezra does it. So Malbim's two forms are Mashal and Melitza. That's in my heading above source number 12. You see it there? Mashal and Melitza. So we usually think of Mashal as a parable. And basically the Mashal is the narrative of Shir HaShirim. It's the story. It's just telling the story of Shir HaShirim. That's the Mashal part. Melitza is the philosophical layer beneath it that the text is hinting to. So he has two commentaries running through the book, one just explaining the story and the other one the deeper meaning. We're going to be focusing on his Melitza, the deeper meaning one. Fascinatingly, he blends the two, and this is something that I was really struck by in this, and it made me think, oh, I so want to do Malbim. Because those who did Malachim with me last year will remember that Shlomo HaMelech has four communications from God. We had a whole debate whether it's prophecy, whether the prophet Achya HaShiloni communicates it to him, is it Ruach HaKodesh, right? We had all of these discussions last year about whether he qualifies as a prophet or not. That's not really my point. My point is that he has four prophetic messages from God, and Malbim blends the two layers, the superficial story and the message underneath it, by saying that the book is actually built in units around those four experiences that Shlomo has with God. It's really remarkable. And the way this plays out is with a love triangle. In Malbim's view, the book should not be read the way that most read it, which is there's a love story between the Raya and the Dod, but rather, it's a little more challenging than that. The love triangle is God, the human being, and material desire. God, the human being, and material desire. And the way it works, and I put this in source number 12, the Ra'aya, the female, is us, it's the soul. We are in love with God. The beloved, male, the Dod, is God. And the Dod is a ro'eh, is a shepherd, because God shepherds his creations. So far, so good. Here's where things get weird. Shlomo, King Solomon, is the Yetzer. He represents the desires of the flesh, living inside the royal palace, which is the human body. And the idea is that Solomon is trying to draw the Ra'aya away from the Dod. That's the idea. Now, all the other players, the guards who circulate in the city, the daughters of Jerusalem, the daughters of Zion, are all the same thing. They are the powers of the body, as you see I wrote on the sheet, which restrain the soul from leaving the body. We don't want you becoming too spiritual. They are appointed by Shlomo / the Yetzer to keep the soul in check. You follow? I find this a lot easier for me to grasp than the whole active intellect thing, I have to say. I mean, the language makes it into Malbin, but this is something I can sort of understand. You have the human soul wants to get close to God, and you have the material forces that want to keep it away from God and use the powers of the body to keep the soul from becoming too spiritual. That, in a nutshell, is Malbin. So the structure of the book is in six songs. You may recall, and I'm going to bring out my Tanakh here. I gave you the reference in source number 13. Take a look. Melachim Aleph, chapter 5, sentence 12. Chapter 5, sentence 12. This is where we talk about Shlomo's poetry. So it says, Vayidaber shloshes alafim mashal, he spoke 3,000 parables. Vayihi shiro, and his songs or poems were chamishava aleph. We were bothered by that when we read that last year. What do you mean 5 and 1,000? If someone composes 1,005 poems, you can just say he composed 1,000 poems. Right? Why do you need to say 1,005? What are you adding with your 1,005? And we gave different explanations of it last year. I'm not going to go through all the commentaries that we did at that point. But he says the way you should read it is it's 5 plus a song involving the word Aleph. Because the last song speaks of Ish Yavi Bifiryo Aleph Kasef. It speaks about the Aleph is the reward there for mitzvos and for religious growth. So it's 5 songs and the song of religious growth at the end. That's the way that he reads this. So he says that's, Malachim is talking about Shir HaShirim, is his point. And what exactly is the story? 5 times the soul escapes the body to go to the Dod. The first 4 times were when King Solomon lived, like we learned last year, via experiences of prophecy. But each time the daughters of Jerusalem awakened their forces and brought him back to his body. On the 5th occasion, when he died, his soul left the body and went to be with God. That's the way Malbim reads it. Take a look on your sheet at source number 14 where you'll see it. The first one is when he has his dream in Givon. In Malachim, it was in chapter 3. That was when God promised him, I'll give you whatever you want. Right? He got close to God then. That's your first song. The second prophecy is when he is going to build the Beis HaMikdash. That's one of them that isn't really a full prophecy. But that's the second one. Then the third prophecy is when he has built the temple, built the Beis HaMikdash, and he brings sacrifices. And at that point, he's on a very high level, and everything is wonderful. But then, as you remember, things go downhill. Because of the wives he married and all these political marriages, he becomes more distant from God, and God comes to him and rebukes him with the fourth prophecy. Then we are told that Shlomo will reunite with God when he dies, and the forces of the body try to keep the soul within the body, but the love for God is strong, and that's when you get to the last vision. And then in the last bit, the soul appeals to God to save the hilic intellect. Don't leave it in the body. It can be purified via its mitzvot, and it can survive the death of the body. By the way, for anyone who hasn't had enough of the hilic intellect, you can come to my Shmuel Shir, the women can anyway, my Shmuel Shir on Thursday afternoon, because it's actually going to come up there in the discussions of what happened with Shlomo and the witch in Endor. So we'll have to talk about that one, the whole Ove story. But one of the views that we're going to bring there, it involves the hilic intellect. So for those who didn't get enough of it today, you know, there's always Thursday. To show you this within Malbim's commentary, take a look at source number 15, please. This is his introduction to the Melitza part of his commentary. He says, Shir ze nechlak v'chamisha shirim. This poem is divided into five poems. Siper b'shira soki amelach Shlomo rotze lomer hayetzer v'koach hamis orer shalguf Shlomo. It tells how Shlomo, meaning the yetzer, the awakening force of his body, Shlomo's body, ahav raya achas bat shamayim. He loved this girl who was from heaven. The he nishmaso haruchanit ha'elokita shenisgara begviato. That's the soul. The Yetzer loves the soul. Mekom Malchus Hayetzer Mimshalto, which is locked up there in the palace of the of Shlomo. Vayasem Venos Yerushalayim, and he took the daughters of Jerusalem, so to speak. Heim Kochot HaChomriot LeMinehem, those are the material forces. Shomrim Sviva, and made them guards around her. Lahashkia Osa B'Chomer, to sink her in the material, ulmoshchal ritzono lios lo pilegesh, so that she would be drawn to his will, so that she would be his concubine. Abalhi aisak shura b'moserot ahava do daba shemayim, but she loves God, her beloved in heaven. Siv osav asher bara, who shepherds the forces that are the masses that he created. V'yatza'ach hamisha pamim min hagviya, so five times she left the body. She hechal hayetzer hamolech shama, which is the palace of the yetzer that reigns there. V'hischabrayim doda asher ba'aravot b'shmei kedem, and she joined with the dode up in the heavens. Aravot is one of the names for the heavens, one of the heavens. Be'arba'ah pa'amim harishonim, the first four times, hispashtim and hagviya ba'ot Shlomo chai, the soul left the body while Shlomo lived. It's very weird because he's using the word Shlomo in two different ways in these paragraphs. He's using Shlomo to mean the Yetzer, but he's also using it to mean King Solomon. That gets confusing. Al yidei shechalo leharuach eloki b'maros elokim arba'ah pa'amim, these four times she leaves the physical via the visions of God. V'shava b'chol pa'am el ha'gviya kisur hamareh, but each time the vision ended, and then she returned to the body. Be'ez his'oru b'nos Yerushalayim shem kochos ha'chomriyos mishnasam, when the daughters of Jerusalem, the material forces, awakened from their sleep. U'pa'am ha'chamishi, the fifth time, yatz'av v'nifredam en ha'gviya eiz ne'esav Shlomo alamav. She left the body when Shlomo returned to his people, meaning when he died. V'davka be'lokeh b'tzrora chayim la'netzach, she stuck to her God forever. U'b'chol shir v'shir yisaper eich hispashta v'nachomer v'nidbekaim doda panim el panim, and in each of the poems, it tells how she left the material and clung to her beloved face to face. Clear? Got it? I mean, that was just a summary of what we said. I hope that was somewhat clear. I wouldn't want it to be too clear. Then I'd be out of a job. So that's what Malbim does. So what I brought you here on the sheet are some of Malbim's comments on the first song to try to make this a little bit more clear. Like, you'll actually see it play out as Ricky had wanted with Ralbag, but I didn't feel it was doable with Ralbag. But it is doable with Malbim. And what I'd like to do is take you through the first song. In the event that you want to see more of what Malbim does to the book as a whole, I'll be glad to do more Malbim next week. If you feel like, okay, saw it, let's move on, totally understand. So let's see where this goes. He begins by telling us about Shlomo's first prophecy in Gibeon. Shir Hashirim Asher Lishlomo. This is the poem of Shlomo. Sorry, Mesh, you're going to have to hang out until we're done with the first song. Okay, so he says, Misaper eich hispashta haraya hashmimit min hagviya b'pam harishon. It tells how the heavenly ra'aya separated from the body the first time, al yedei hamar'a rishona, via the first vision. Asher nir'ah Hashem al Shlomo b'chalom halayla b'givon, when God appeared to Shlomo in a dream at night in Givon, as is mentioned in Malachim and Divrei Hayamim. V'yisaper be'eza ofen hayah chizayon hazeh. It tells how this vision took place. V'eich nischabra im hakodesh, V'nach aleha ruach, how she joined with the Holy and the Spirit rested upon her. Ve'ech shava el ha-gviyah, and how she returned to the body. Vayikat Shlomo v'hineh chalom, and Shlomo awoke and it was a dream. So that's the introduction to this first poem. If you were to think back to the beginning of Shir HaShirim, so I didn't bring you all of Malbim on the first poem, I brought you select parts. It says, Moshcheni acharecha narutza. She says to God, she says, draw me and I will run after you. Right? Ring a bell? Moshcheni, draw me near, acharecha narutza, and I will run after you. So Malbim says, take a look at source number 17. Moshcheni, draw me near. V'hotzi eini min hamasger hazeh, take me out of this prison. Shehum en hachomer hasochech beini uvei maros elokim, which is this material, body that obstructs between me and divine visions. V'hu ayedei shetachol alea shefa hanevuit. This will happen when she has the prophetic experience. So she's asking God, the neshama is asking God, give me contact, be in touch with me, give me prophecy. And then, following further in the first chapter in Shir HaShirim, she says, Al tir'uni sha'ani shechar chores. Don't see me as blackened, as black, shesafasni ha'shamesh, the sun has blackened me. I'm not going through the black part of it, I'm focusing on the second part of it. B'nei imi nicharuvi, the sons of my mother forced me, samuni noteras hakramim, they made me guard the vineyards. Karmishali lonatarti, I never guarded my own vineyard. What is that a reference to? What's with guarding vineyards? Take a look at number 18, and I stopped translating with 17, so I'm just going to translate it on the fly. Samuni noteras hakramim, they made me a guard of the vineyards. Hamlitza tedameh peulos sheyaseha adam lahasig al yadam eze tachlis linitias kerem. The Melitza here, the deeper layer of the text, compares the actions that you perform to achieve a particular goal, any goal, with planting a vineyard. Shebe'es yavshilu ashkalosea anavim, because when the grapes ripen, nomar shehisig es hatchalas hatachlis, that's when you have achieved the beginning of your goal. So anytime you want to achieve something, that's like planting a vineyard. When you get what you were trying to get, that's when the grapes are available. Ve'es yidrochas anavim, and when you trample the grapes, v'yimtze yayin ve'yekavim, and you find the wine in the collection units in the wine press, nomar sheba letachlis hanirtza, that's when you have achieved the goal. That's the metaphor. Ve'heim samuni not lintor kramim acherim, but they made me guard other vineyards. Rotzalomar, meaning lishmor tachlitim acherim, they made me guard other purposes. Bilti shayachim al tachliti ve'oshri, which had nothing to do with my goals, had nothing to do with what I want, what's going to make me happy. Kmo lahasig malchus ve'osher, like they made me want to gain power, to become wealthy, umisra and authority, tava, desire, vechemda, also desire, v'domayam, and things like that. The soul is saying, I was made to guard foreign vineyards. I was made to pursue other things that don't make me happy, that aren't really what I want. I was forced to pursue goals that are not my spiritual goals. Got it? You follow? And then in sentence 8, the Dode responds, Im lo sedi'i lach hayafa banashim. I'm reading sentence 8 in Shir HaShirim. If you don't know, most beloved of women, most beautiful of women, Tzi'ilach bi'ikvei hatzon, go out to the footsteps of the sheep. Ure'iyas gidiyo sayach, graze your goats, al mishkenos haro'im, upon the tents of the shepherds. So Malbim says, this is God's advice for how to become close to Him. Here's what you need to do. Source number 19. Shetivrachi mechatzar hamelech. The Tavoi Eli, you have to run away from the king's court, meaning the body. The Tavoi Li, and you have to come to me. Rotzalomar shetaz vias hayetzer. You have to leave the yetzer behind, the tavos and the desires, the inyanei agviya and the pursuits of the body. You have to involve yourself in examination. You have to involve yourself in ideas. Until you achieve my truth. What you need are two things. Aleph. You have to know my place. You have to know where you can find me. Rotzalomar meaning... You have to know the path to achieve truth. How you can enter the orchard. The orchard, the place of hidden knowledge. To recognize the Creator. That's one. You need to know how to find me. And second, you have to find ways to avoid being held up by Shlomo's forces. You need two things, God says, if you want to find me. You need to know where to look for me, and you need to know how to avoid the body dragging you down. Okay, how do I do that? Don't worry, I'm going to tell you. He says, Hine, al harishon, you know, I see we have 3 minutes left, so I'm going to rush through this and just tell it to you, summarizing what he says in the Hebrew, but you can see the Hebrew yourself there. He says, first of all, you have to know my place. Meaning you have to know who I am. How? By seeing the footsteps of the sheep. Meaning, what that means is, you have to examine my deeds. You have to examine the things that I've done in creating the world. The chesed that I have employed, the mercy, the kindness involved in running humanity, that's what you need to see in order to know my nature, in order to be able to find me. That's number one. And number two, in order to keep from being held back, you have to shepherd your goats, meaning you have to shepherd your forces, your talents, your abilities, all those things in you that can draw you astray. You have to be in charge, and you have to be their shepherd. You have to run them. That's what you need. Got it? I'm sorry, am I going too fast? Yes, no, someone tell me? That's clear? Okay. As clear as it's gonna get. So Malbim says that what we're saying here is, you wanna find God, you have to examine God's actions, and you have to avoid being drawn away by your desires, much like what Ralbag said. And then this section ends with Hishbati. The oath, Hishpati Eschem Benos Yerushalayim, daughters of Jerusalem, the traits of the body. I want you to swear not to overwhelm me and not to draw me away from God. And also, don't try to draw me to God when I'm not ready, because that won't work either. It has to be at the right time, so forces of the body, don't try to lead me where I don't belong. That's the way Malbim reads the first song. So we could, if you want, do more of Malbim next time, or we can move on from Malbim. Our next step is to look at some of the more contemporary commentaries. This basically completes the classics, and then we have some contemporary ones to see. I've got somebody sent me a direct message in the chat saying more Malbim would be great. Yep, I hear people wanting a little more Malbim. Okay. So we'll do some more Malbim, not too much, because I think it is a lot, but I'm going to see, I have some ideas for more things to bring in that I think are fascinating and will help enlighten us a little bit more. And then we'll come to the more modern ones. I got a half and half comment. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. I hope this wasn't too much torture for those who are not philosophically minded and didn't live in the 14th century. No, we're good? Okay. Thanks for the thumbs ups. All right. Be well. Have a good week.